Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
I'm Manny.
And this is your new comic book day episode for November 18th, 2020. Manny and I are going to be talking about a few of the books that hit stands today that we've had a chance to read already. Spoiler free, of course. And then I'll give a rundown on some of the other titles that you might want to be on the lookout for. So why don't you go ahead and kick it off, Manny? What do you want to talk about first?
I'll kick it off with Aftershock's Dead Day number 5. This is the series finale by Ryan Parrott, with art by Evangeline Bornyakov, with colors by Juancho. I gotta say, I had such kind of, I was ready to just go along for the ride for this book because I like the concept of the dead coming back and you know, once a year. And I thought we were going to get a little bit more into that mystery of how they got back and things like that. But the story really ended up being kind of it's a revenge story, but at the same time, it really lacked excitement, and it ended up being really bland. The character of Melissa, who really is a callous to everything, with her ex coming back, Jeremy, and looking for revenge, as we've seen in the previous issues, really ends in a lackluster note. I can't really talk much about it, but I have to say that I'm a little sadly disappointed in how it kind of wraps up. I expected a little bit more from it, and in the end, everyone, I can't even talk about that much. I hate to say something like that, like it lacks creativity, but that's really what I feel like. Like it lacks, I don't know, a little bit of spices here and there throughout the last 2-3 issues, to really have that climatic moment that you kind of look for in a story arc. And it's over now, so it's not like I have to worry about an issue 6.
Yeah, I haven't read it. I mean, I'm a fan of Ryan Parrott and his previous work at Aftershock, and you know, he's wildly popular on the Power Rangers series that he does.
Right. I kind of expect a little bit more excitement from the story, which is why it's kind of throwing me off. I don't understand what maybe he was going for as far as an ending, that this is the road he decided to take.
Yeah, so that's too bad. Here's the other thing too. It's like a lot of these Aftershock titles, I feel like sometimes they're kind of limited because I don't think the sales are really great on them. You know, the shelves are so crowded, and sometimes I feel like they're limited. You know, they only get the 5 issues. And then, you know, maybe it's not enough time to really tell the whole story they want to tell. I'm struggling to remember the last Aftershock title that went over 5 issues. You know, obviously we had things like Animosity, Insects, Black Eyed Kids early on. Obviously, A Walk Through Hell, but that's Garth Ennis. What's that?
The spy one also, what's his name?
Oh, Jimmy's Bastards.
Jimmy's Bastards.
Yeah, and Rough Riders.
Oh, that was good.
Those came out early on when there was a lot of buzz. You know, Aftershock was new and shiny. And so you just wonder about some of these other series if they're not able to, you know, just find an audience with how crowded the shelves are. Because it's too bad, because, you know, a lot of these series are really good, and you really want to see more than what we've seen so far from some of these titles. So
yeah, I'm still waiting for that for Jimmy and Amanda to get back on that damn book.
Oh yeah, Super Zero. Yeah.
Super Zero.
Yeah, that's another one. And for that matter, Relay. Not Relay. That's another Aftershock title that only went 5 issues. Replica is the one I'm thinking of.
Oh, yeah.
By Paul Jenkins, that which was a good one. so good. It's my favorite Aftershock series. And Paul even hinted earlier, was it late? I think it was earlier this year that he was thinking about bringing it back or you know, something that was on his radar. And then obviously COVID happened and who knows where that's at now, but definitely would love to see that come back for sure. So. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let me go ahead and talk about first book on my list. I guess I'll start with Aquaman number 65, the Deep End finale. So this ends the run for Kelly Sue DeConnick on the title. Miguel Mondoca is the artist. Romulo Fajardo Jr. handles the colors. Clayton Cowles on letters. And it's a great way to end it, but it also ends in a way that I sort of expected it to. And I don't want to say that it's unfinished, because Kelly Sue does wrap up, you know, all her storylines and everything she's been building toward. But I'll put it this way. I feel like there's more story to tell here. Like Kelly Sue has laid the foundation, not necessarily for a new direction to Aquaman, but to continue to tell the story of Aquaman and Mira and this supporting cast that she's built over the last 20 issues, 25 issues. It's all foundational. And there's now it's time for, obviously not Kelly Sue because she's moving on, but for the next writer to come in and pick up those toys and move forward. I hope whoever comes on next, and we're not sure that Aquaman is even going to continue at this point. We know that the next couple of issues of Aquaman will be a tie-in to the Endless Winter storyline in December. Now, obviously, in January and February, we have the Future State series. But after that, we don't know if Aquaman's going to continue or not. I hope that if it does, like I said, it's not some writer coming in and saying, all right, let's throw out everything Kelly Sue's done. I'm going to do my own thing. Because, like I said, she's really laid some great foundation with Aquaman and Mira getting married in this final issue with their baby and what powers their child might have with what's been happening with the political aspects of Atlantis and the other undersea kingdoms. There's things with Aqualad and his ties to Black Manta. There's a lot that's been sort of set up there to kind of continue to explore. In talking about this, her run as a whole, starting with issue 43, I think that first arc, and especially the last issue of that arc, and then the following issue where Aquaman rediscovers who he is. If you're not familiar, so you know Aquaman had died at the end of that Justice League drowned Earth event, and rather than being sent to the afterlife, he gets sent to this island to be a champion for the ocean, but he loses all his memories and he meets some old sea gods from different cultures there. And again, a really great job by Kelly Sue of breaking down the character so that she can build him back up again. I mean, it's kind of a tried and true way to sort of reboot and relaunch a character, just bring it back to its roots, right? And that's what Kelly Sue did. And so that first arc is good, but the issue that comes right after that first arc, where Arthur gets his memories back, there is a two-issue story, and it is so perfect. It so encapsulates who Aquaman is. You know, we've had different takes and different iterations. You know, some people have called him boring. We had in the 90s, the Peter David run where, you know, he got the hook for a hand and he had the long hair and the beard. That was the first time we saw that. He had, you know, it was the 90s, so he was angry and it was much more of an edge. And then we had the Geoff Johns run, which was kind of a throwback to the Silver Age, but kind of leveling him up in power and bring a little bit of humor to it, where it was kind of tongue in cheek. He was making fun of himself, talking to fish and all that kind of stuff. Kelly Sue takes all those different aspects and she really melds them together. And it like, if you're only going to read two issues of her run, read those two issues, because that for me sums up who Aquaman is so well. And then I feel like everything that came after was interesting and very foundational, like I said, but the cast of the story was so big that I feel like we didn't get a lot of character growth from Arthur, from Aquaman. He was sharing the spotlight in his own book with Mira and those, you know, elder sea gods I was talking about, and characters from Amnesty Bay, and the action was pretty fast paced. And so there wasn't a lot of character development, not that there necessarily needed to be, because she had already established who he was and gotten back to his roots. But that's what I say about it being a foundational run, because the next person who comes in, you can take the time to, you know, pick up those toys and tell stories with everything that Kelly Sue built, but also take an issue here or there for some quiet moments to explore Arthur and kind of who he is now with the new status quo that's going on. So I haven't been paying attention to the sales numbers for Aquaman, so I don't know how much DC would be interested in continuing. We know they're trying to cut their bottom 25-30% of sales, and to hear some people say it, they're going to get out of the monthly issues altogether. I hope that's not the case. I kind of doubt it. I mean, the thing is, their monthly still make money, but it's like, how much money does it need to make in order for them to justify? You know, if we've talked over and over about the huge amount of debt that AT&T is carrying, and you know, their decision making is not good. I'm just going to put it that way. You know, we talk about Pamela Lyford, and you know, somebody decides to give Zack Snyder $70 million to make a bad movie worse, apparently, from everything I've seen. Only 4 minutes of you know, new filmed footage for $70 million. A Steppenwolf that looks worse than ever. I just don't get it. Like, how many of those people that DC's laid off recently could they have kept paying so we can keep having good comics come out instead of giving it to Zack Snyder to throw away? It infuriates me. So I hope Aquaman continues, but I guess we're gonna have to wait and see. All right, Manny, what do you have up next?
Aquaman's such a difficult character, I think, to tell stories with, just because of the fact that he has to deal with really an other set of worlds that may even be more complicated than the Spectrum sometimes. And then just the fact that he's on Earth and he's not, and then sometimes his powers are determined by the writer. It's tough. I know that Geoff Johns had a good run with Aquaman. I think Jeff Parker did when he did Maelstrom. I really like that. And also, but then when it was time for Cullen Bunn to do his run on it, it didn't work out. Not to say that Cullen Bunn's not a fantastic writer, because he is. We've seen him in all the amazing things he does in the horror genre in comics, but Aquaman's tough.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing about it is, I mean, I think a lot of people look at Geoff Johns' run when the New 52 started as kind of the best of recent memory. Kelly Sue's run is really, in tone, it feels a lot like that. Like who Aquaman is feels a lot like what Jeff was doing. And when you say it's tough, you know, in terms of different writers are going to give him different powers. I mean, that's the thing. That's why I say Kelly Sue's run is foundational. She has set all that up. She has set it all up perfectly. So, you know who he is. You know what level of power he is. You know what his standing is in Atlantis. You know who, you know, there's a big supporting cast, so there's a lot of different stories to tell. So that's why I hope, if it does continue, the next writer that comes in, just pick up and keep telling stories in this world. Don't like reboot it. Don't get rid of all the supporting cast and completely do your own thing. Tell the stories you want to tell, but do it in the setting that she has established. She's done such a great job of establishing who Aquaman is and what his world is currently. Just pick up with that. The only thing that kind of, I prefer the short haired, clean shaven Aquaman. And ever since the Jason Momoa movie came out, we've got the bearded, long haired Aquaman.
Yeah.
Probably for obvious reasons, you know, probably because that's what he is in the movies. So we still have that. And I wish we'd get away from that because I do prefer the short hair and the clean shaven. But, you know, there's Aquaman 2 coming down the line at some point. So I don't expect the long hair and the beard to go away at any time soon. But yeah, I feel like it's the character and his supporting cast and the setting is in a really good place. Kelly Sue left it in a really good place. And I'd love to see another writer just come in and tell stories in that setting. So I guess we'll see.
Well, speaking of someone who's really built his own world over at Gotham, we're going to talk about Batman 103 by James Tynion IV, with artwork by Guillermo March and Carlo Pagulayan. And Danny Mickey, with colors by David Barron. And this is probably the second part of kind of post-Joker War. And now we're dealing with Ghostmaker, who was kind of revealed last issue, is really a teenage rival of Bruce Wayne that Tynion decided to introduce. And the biggest thing now is he's in Gotham to kind of do the job Batman has not been able to do, and kind of standing in the middle as an I told you so is Clown Hunter, who Ghostmaker is after, you know, it's a. And in between then, we see Harley Quinn get her own apartment and talking to Poison Ivy via plants, or just talking to plants as if she was Poison Ivy. So we see kind of her feelings on how she feels towards her. In this issue, it starts off, these were in the preview pages, so it's not like I'm giving anything away. Desert scenes of Bruce Wayne and this other guy, who ends up being Ghostmaker, and kind of you get the idea that they've traveled the world not together, but they take they go to the same destinations at different times. They've trained with similar teachers, different martial arts techniques, different meditation techniques, and really trying to one up each other, to be kind of, I guess, the best. And so, I don't know. It's like, it's good, but I just don't know what kind of lasting power this character is going to have. His whole outfit to me is really vague. I think maybe his costume was a little bit more interesting, it's kind of, to me, it's kind of bland. And I will say what I like about what Tynion's doing is really questioning whether or not Bruce Wayne, Batman, really belongs in Gotham. And the question is, what happens if he's not around? So can somebody else take over? Do they even need him at all? One of the most interesting parts of the comic, I thought, was one of the people that Ghostmaker had brought into justice was a serial killer that nobody was able to really pinpoint because of the fact that he didn't leave clues, he didn't wear a mask, he didn't have an alter ego. He was just a regular guy killing people, and thus made it very difficult for police officers to track him. I thought that was kind of funny. But with the next, I'll be really interested to see what happens in the next issue with how it's set up. it seems like it's going to have the potential to really make him Ghost Hunter a more interesting character. And it's just a matter of the way he's developed. Not holding my breath very much, because we know that there's a lot of other stuff going on at DC soon. So we'll see. In total it was okay.
I actually really like his design.
I like his early design. I don't like the gadget design.
So when they're in the desert, you like that better?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I could see that. But I think he's kind of set up as a foil to Batman. Okay. Here's Batman if he did things in a different way. You know, if he wanted to, and this argument's been made, you know, time and time again about the whole revolving door of Arkham Asylum, and the Batman just, you know, killed people and they wouldn't come back to, you know, it's Batman's fault that Joker comes back and kills people, because if Batman would just kill the Joker, then, and I get that argument. Like, I totally understand. And that's kind of the mirror that Batman's looking in and Ghostmaker's looking back, right? Like, here's a guy that can do a lot of what Batman does, but he does take that extra step to make sure they don't come back. I mean, that's right there in the name. He kills people. He turns them into ghosts. And so, and the other part of his name is being that he's, you know, impossible to track down, and nobody's really ever heard of him except for Batman, because he is a ghost himself. So I get all that, and it's kind of interesting, but I also understand what you're saying, where it's kind of like, is this really that interesting or original of a concept? No, not really. It's kind of been done before. The other thing that really I noticed in the issue, say whether I, you know, like it or not necessarily, was, so is Harley going to be like one of the main supporting characters in Batman going forward now? Cause she's got,
it seems like it.
She's got all kinds of, you know, last few issues, she's got all kinds of panel space.
Yeah. Panel space.
She's all over the place. So yeah, I liked the idea originally of what we heard Tynan was going to do after Joker War. You know, Batman doesn't have the resources he had before. He doesn't have his fortune. He's got to, you know, repair his own equipment and, you know, that kind of thing. And he's in the city. And I thought we were going to get some more grounded kind of detective kind of stories, you know, solving mysteries, because Batman's got to, you know, his resources are more limited, and it's not some big bombastic world that he's in. You know, he's not the world's richest man or whatever, second richest man or whatever it might be. It's, but we're not getting any of that.
It's funny you mention that, because besides the Bat family complaining about it, I haven't necessarily seen it be a factor for him.
Yeah, exactly. It hasn't. We're still telling the same old kind of Batman stories. Batman fighting against supervillains.
Like, I need to see him like trying to track somebody down, and all of a sudden realizing he doesn't have another Bat grappler, or he's looking for a batarang or something.
Yeah, some kind of consequences, and that we haven't seen that yet. So I will say that one of the things I did enjoy about the issue was, you know, you mentioned Ghostmaker calling out Batman on, hey, you know, you won't do the things that are necessary, and him saying, look what I did, and I hadn't even, when I got to Gotham, I hadn't even, you know, really got to Gotham yet. And then you find out later that Batman, he was kind of aware of those things, and he had, you know, plans within plans within plans. So just a reminder that Batman's always, you know, further down the path than you necessarily think he might be. So that was just a little reminder. I thought that was kind of true to form, but I don't know. I mean, James Tynan, he's a great writer. But I don't know. I'm not feeling it. Like, I had defended him. I know Joker War wasn't great. A lot of people had a lot of problems with it, pacing wise and plot wise. I'm like, just, you know, he's got to get that Joker story out of the way, and then we'll get some good Batman stuff. You know, he wrote Detective before that. I thought his Detective run started out really strong, and it kind of lost some steam going on.
It had to take on the form of Joker War.
I'm talking about his, when they did Rebirth, when he
did Detective. Okay, yeah,
because Tomasi's on Detective now. But yeah, even that kind of lost some steam after a little while. So I like, again, he's a great writer. I'm a real fan of his, but I don't know how long I'm going to stick with Batman, because it's been, I don't want to say it's been bad. Maybe it's just me. I'm bringing too much expectation to it. it's just been a little bit underwhelming. Like I think almost my favorite issue so far was 101 after the Joker War ended, and that 101 kind of set up, okay, here's how it's going to be going forward. He doesn't have resources. He's going to be on his own. It's going to be more street level. And then the two issues we've had after that have been, you know, him dealing with Ghostmaker, and it hasn't been street level at all. We're still supervillains. We're still, you know, like you said, there's no consequences shown yet for him, you know, not having the Bat Cave and not having Alfred there. So I don't know. I'm still on board for now. I'm not bailing yet, but I want something different, I guess, is what I'm getting at. Like, I feel like we're getting the same old kind of Batman stories, you know, Batman fighting a costume villain. Give me some mystery. Give me some world's greatest detective kind of stuff, you know, like Tomasi and Brad Walker and the other artists have been working over on Detective. I mean, at least you feel like you get some variety over there. It's not the same old feel of the stories every month. So let me talk about my next book, also a DC book, also in the Batman family. It's Nightwing number 76, written by Dan Jurgens, art by Ronan Cliquet, colors are by Nick Filardi, letters by Ann World Design. And the reason I wanted to talk about this is it kind of finally wraps up the whole Dick Grayson got shot in the head by KG Beast and lost his memories and then got his memories back. We saw that happen in Joker War. And then when I talked about issue 75, we talked about the KG Beast showing back up in Bloodhaven and wanting to kind of correct his mistake and take out Nightwing once and for all. Because we saw in issue 75 that the kind of the underworld that KG Beast is a part of, they're ridiculing him and making fun of him for not completing that assassination contract on Nightwing. So we get a resolution to that in this story. And I don't want to say that it's bad, but it is a little cliche. Like, you know, and at the end of the day, Nightwing is going to win, but it ends up not being as much of a fight as you would think it would be. You know, the KG Beast has fought Batman nearly to a standstill before, right? I mean, that really famous story where in the Batman series where KG Beast first shows up, it's a 4-part series, and Batman, you know, has him cornered and KG Beast cuts off his own hand to escape. And then later he chases him into a blind room in a sewer and KG Beast turns around. He's like, okay, here we go. We're going to find out once and for all, you know, which one of us is the best. And Batman just locks him in there. Like, I have no reason to fight against you. I have nothing to prove because he knows KG Beast is that dangerous. And it sort of feels like Nightwing's able to defeat him kind of easily. But it is interesting because it does kind of play into the idea that KG Beast, when he attacked Robin the first time, he did it from afar because maybe he knows he's slipping. He's getting older. Maybe he knows he wasn't quite a match for Dick Grayson one-on-one. So I don't know. It just felt like it was a little anticlimactic. It ended up feeling a little bit easy for Nightwing to take him out. And then the rest of the issue is really him kind of resolving his relationships in Bloodhaven and making some decisions about that. And I don't want to say any more than that because, again, I don't want to spoil. But it ends up feeling a little bittersweet at the end of the day. But it is nice to have the Dick Grayson persona back as opposed to this Rick that he was for a little while. So I think Dan Jurgens is continuing on the title, but again, just like we were talking about with Aquaman, it's hard to say. I mean, there's no word that Nightwing has been canceled. There's been no word of a new creative team, but we just don't know what March is going to hold for Nightwing. So if they decide to stop it, they did set it up where, yeah, this could be the last issue, or it could have a sort of a new direction or new creative team going forward. So, I guess we'll have to wait and see. So this does wrap everything up satisfactorily, but it's not like a really great, oh, you gotta read this Nightwing story kind of situation. But Dan Juergens does get to really resolve everything that's been going on in Nightwing since he took over. So at least it was a satisfying conclusion, if not overwhelmingly great. All right, what do you have up next, Manny?
I also have a DC book from their Black Label, Rorschach number 2, by Tom King, with art by George Fornes and Dave Stewart. Let's just say how it is. This is a total King book here. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. If you're a fan of the way Tom King writes, then I mean, Rorschach. As I'm reading this issue, I'm like, yeah, this is a book that, you know, King's meant to write. Just with the way he writes. If you think back to the way he did Heroes in Crisis, and I mean, what the long run that he did with Batman, and then what he's doing right now with Strange Adventures, and then what he did with Mr. Miracle, it's dense. You're gonna have to pick up little things, I think, each issue, and kind of put it all together like a puzzle. And it's really cool because in this case, we're looking at an investigation through the eyes of a detective who's trying to figure out what the connection is between this older gentleman who was a comic book artist and Rorschach and the people who tried to kill the president. So in this case, the detective's looking into the Will Meyerson, who was known for drawing pirate comics, Pontius Pirate, as he's named, and talking with people in the apartment building where he lived at, someone who actually had a one date relationship with him, and then things like that. So that's really the issue is the accounts of what the detective is finding throughout his apartment and what he's finding out and talking to other people that live there, some of the strange behavior that he encounters, as well as a comic book that he finds that he had done that leads him to another apartment as well. We're not going to get into details, obviously, but with that said, I like this more than the first issue. I think the in-depth detective work, I really enjoyed. And like I said, with it being King that's writing, you know that it's going to be very detailed and very meaningful later. So some of the things maybe that you don't understand now. A good issue. And I think that afterwards, this is going to be one of those series that is going to, like we say with a lot of Tom King's runs, it's going to be so much better in the end when you're able to read it in one sitting.
Yeah, so this last weekend, excuse me, friend of the show, Jason Inman, had a live stream on YouTube with a bunch of different comic guests to raise money for sending care packages to a lot of service members at home and abroad. And so it was great. He had Kevin Smith on and Mitch Gerrits and Doc Shaner, as well as Tom King. And so they kind of opened it up to some questions. They had a little bit of time after talking about Strange Adventures. And I asked, I said, you know, when you look at Watchmen, it was set in the 80s, came out in the 80s, and was set in the 80s. So it was set in present day. But anybody who's read Watchmen, I think, would agree that it has very much a pulp feel, like a 1930s feel. It feels a little old-fashioned in a way. And one of the best things about this Rorschach series that Tom King is doing is it has that same kind of crime noir feel. You know, like Manny said, especially in the second issue, first issue is a lot of set up the crime, let's meet the investigator. And then with issue two, King is really able to kind of dive into the crime noir aspect. Here's this detective investigating this mystery, and we're getting little clues. And I had asked in the live stream about if that was true, if he was trying to give it that pulp feel. and what were some of his inspirations? And he mentioned a bunch of different inspirations. So I encourage you to go to YouTube and look at Jawin's channel, J-A-W-I-I-N, and you can find that live stream and you can hear what Tom says. He talks about pulling inspiration for that kind of pulp feel from a lot of different places, even more modern stuff like Columbo, when you talk about kind of the detective aspect of it. So I agree with Manny to an extent. It does feel very King, very Tom King-ish or Tom King-like, but this isn't as confusing or as layered or nuanced or complicated as something like Heroes in Crisis or even Mr. Miracle. I think this is, if you've never read Tom King or you've said, you know what, I've read Tom King's work before and I haven't liked it because it's too complicated or it's too clever, this is a lot more traditional, I feel like. Obviously, in this issue too, we're getting kind of two timelines because it's the detective in current time investigating, but then in flashback, we're also seeing the events that he's kind of learning about. And obviously, we're getting more information because we're seeing those in a separate timeline than the detective's getting. And so we have, as the reader, have a little more insight than even the detective has. And so, yeah, but it's not hard to follow. But yeah, it is Tom King. He's never just going to tell a story. Here's point A, point B, point C. It's not what he does. And I know some people don't like that. But if you have read his stuff before and you haven't liked it, I would still encourage you to give this a try because I think it is a little more traditional, a little easier to kind of catch on to what Tom King's trying to do. So I thought the second issue was spectacular. I don't know that I liked it because I thought the first issue was really good too. But yeah, I mean, I think Manny's right. This is the case with a lot of Tom King stuff. It's like when you read it as a whole, you're just like, man, that was a great story. And you have moments that you enjoy, but it's not always like, okay, well, this issue was better than that issue, was better than this issue. I mean, a lot of his stuff, and because Rorschach's completely done, he's written the whole series, like it's completely finished. And he mentioned about how he wrote it kind of as a novel. He wrote it as just one story, and then you go and you look, okay, well, let's break it down. This part of the story is issue one, issue two, and so, you know, being that he did it this way, this is going to feel, it's going to be even harder to say, okay, this issue was this, and this issue was different in this way, and I like this issue better than that, because he wrote it as just one thing. So it might be one of those instances where it does read so much better as a complete work, which is true probably of a lot of his shorter stuff. But I like his Batman run. For me, it's not like that. Like it's up and down, and you can judge it based on story arcs and things like that. So, yeah, I wasn't even sure you were reading Rorschach. You were staying up to date on it. So,
well, I mean, it's easy. I read one, and this is two.
Yeah, that's true. But you're right. It is. There are things that show up here that he's foreshadowing, or you'll go back and read it in a whole sitting, the whole thing in one sitting, and you'll think, oh yeah, I see how that tied in now. So yeah, I wouldn't say it's dense, but I just think there's a lot of Easter eggs there. So
it's better. It's better here than it would be on a Heroes in Crisis because it's more focused on one event, one character.
Yeah. Because
there's so many players.
Well, and there's no time travel. Time travel always.
Yeah.
It's always true. Like, oh, damn it, time travel. It's always iffy when you start talking about that. So, all right. Well, I guess I'll go ahead and talk about my third DC book. This is actually my book of the week. And then I have a Marvel and an Independent. So let me go ahead and finish off the DC. And it's Catwoman 27, written by Ram V. The art is by Fernando Blanco. The colors are by FCO Placencia, and the letters are by Tom Napolitano. And the reason this is my book of the week, I wanted to give a shout out to Catwoman. I talked about issue 25 and how good it was. I talked about issue 26 and how good it was. Issue 27, Ram V is just continuing that consistent quality that he's brought to the title right from the beginning. And the art by Fernando Blanco suits the style and the kind of the tone that Ram V is going for. It's, and I said this on Twitter the other day, it's like a Michael Mann movie, if you're familiar with any of his work, like Heat or Collateral, The Thief, just Manhunter, those really great crime movies where the setting, usually LA, is a character in and of itself. And there's, you know, bright lights, and it's got this, you know, the shadows and the feel, and everything looks kind of silky and slick. And it's just, it's great. It's not glamorous though, because it's crime. So there's that gritty underbelly that you see. And Fernando Blanco captures that perfectly. I know you guys can't see it, but I'm going to share my screen with Manny. The title page in this issue by Fernando Blanco it so perfectly encapsulates what I'm talking about. So there's a neon sign coming off a building that says highway robbery. And it's great work by, I don't know if it's Tom Napolitano, because it's the letters for the title, or if Blanco did this, but either way, it's a neon sign that's very much at an angle and hard to draw. So I imagine they must have wrote it regular and then used a computer program to turn it. Otherwise, that's even better work to do that in perspective like that. But it's this neon sign that's glowing pink. So great work by Placencia, who's also done an incredible job on the visuals of this to make it feel gritty and give it that slick feel, but at the same time, the underbelly of crime. So anyway, you have this neon sign popping out of the building. Catwoman's perched on top of it, looking down into an alleyway. And, you know, there's litter on the ground and, you know, it's dirty. It's an alley. There's like puddles of water. Everything looks grimy. The colors are grays and these drab greens. And it just, again, it suits the mood and the tone of the book so well, and it reminds me visually of a Michael Mann movie. It's so perfect. And then when you talk about the writing and what Ram V is doing in the story, again, three issues in, and I feel like this is the most pitch perfect version and voice that Selena has ever had. She's not an out and out criminal, and she's doing things to cause harm to other crime lords or, you know, the heads of these other crime organizations. And so in that way, she's on the side of angels, but at the same time, the things she's doing aren't legal. So very much in that gray area. And she knows it. She's very self-aware. She's very confident in her abilities. And she takes advantage of working with the police. She gives them clues as it suits her needs. So she's very much kind of out for herself. But at the same time, the things she's doing, you root for her. She's obviously the protagonist, but she's not completely on the side of angels. You know, she's not, you wouldn't say, well, she's a hero. You know what I mean? So again, it's very realistic in that way, because you can see her motivations. You can understand why she's doing what she's doing. And you can see why, to bring Batman in, why he would let her do what she's doing, because in the end, she's more on the good than the bad side of things. So, yeah, like I said, probably my favorite Catwoman run that I've read. And there's other things going on. There's other subplots that are building that I don't want to get into because it gets a little spoilery, but it is so, so good. If you are at all a fan of the character of Catwoman, man, you gotta be reading this. It's just, it's really, really good. So I wanted to give it a shout out, making my book of the week, because again, if you're a fan of Michael Mann movies, if you're a fan of Catwoman, if you're a fan of things like Darwin Cook's Parker books from IDW, this is going to be right up your alley. Just really, really good. So, all right, Manny, that's my book of the week. What do you have up next?
I'm going to change it up a little bit. We're going to go with an image book. One of the books that I always talk about, Ice Cream Man 21 by W. Maxwell Prince with art by Martin Morazzo. It's still in the same line as the other Ice Cream Man books. It's an anthology book. This one, so each of them have a separate story. This one is called The Big Sweet. So it follows a detective that is looking into a string of ice cream men murders who are disappearing from town. And it is very interesting how it's all tied in together with his work as a detective and then his personal life. And it's a very, very fun story to follow, just because it also has subtle hints of other things going on at the same time. I thought Prince is very, very clever in the way that he put the story together. It's funny because it's in its description, it says that the style of story can best be described as the French word for black, which is a noir, obviously. And it's true. It's a very in a noir fashion. And if there's one thing I can say about Ice Cream Man so far that I loved, is it's the same concept of the Ice Cream Man, but the story is being told in so many different ways. It's so creative in the way that you're able to bring this kind of mythical horror figure and place him in different realities and even in different languages. There's one issue that's completely done in Spanish, which really threw me off. Brings in children's stories, brings in relationship issues, talks about characters wanting to commit suicide, depression, egos. I mean, just one way or another, he's been able to take this character that he's built, the Ice Cream Man, and put him into these stories, and I think it's fantastic. And it's 21 issues in, it's still continued, and now and we talked about a little bit, we've seen that he's becoming very big with the children's books variant covers. There's even a foil cover that was going for a pretty hefty price, which I wanted to get, but man, I did not want to pay that much for it. I had it in my hands and I was like, nah, not gonna do it. The variant cover for this book is fantastic. It almost has like a you're probably not gonna like it, just because the smile kind of is a little jokerish, but then the eyes are also those smiles. And I think the colors also with the blue and the teal really make those like that sinister smile stick out. I think it's a great cover. It's a great issue, just like any of the other Ice Cream Man books. And I will say though that it is kind of a little bit of an acquired taste. If you're into that kind of the genre, then you really enjoy it. But as far as somebody who's just really reading like a Batman book or Spider-Man, X-Men, it might be an acquired taste that you would take a couple of issues to really get into it. So yeah, good series still. Love it.
All right, I'm going to talk about an independent as well up next. It's We Live, issue number 2 from the writer of the Miranda Brothers, rather, writer's artist. So written it together, and I think, it doesn't necessarily say, but I think Anaki Miranda is the one that handles the art duties. The colors are by Ava De La Cruz and the letters are by Dave Sharp. So the first issue sold out and went to a second printing. I think it took a lot of people by surprise. I did talk about the first issue when it came out. So we're in this post-apocalyptic world. The Earth is heading toward extinction. And supposedly this benevolent alien race is going to rescue, I think it's 5,000 children. And so the children from this that are still left on Earth need to reach certain places on Earth by a certain date to be picked up. by a certain date and time to be picked up and saved. Meanwhile, the Earth is, as I said, it's dystopian. It's ravaged. There's all kinds of strange beasts. There's been, you know, wars and mutations and all that. And so we're following the journey of these people as they try to take these kids to the right place in time. The first issue was a little bit of setup, and then I felt like the pacing was a little choppy, but I kind of attributed that to just needing to get the setup. But I'm finding that that's not the case. If anything, the pacing in the second issue is even a little choppier. It's like halfway through the book, something happens and it takes kind of a turn, and it's almost like it's a big time jump. And I've said this, you know, 100 times before, if not more. The hardest thing to get right for a new comic creator or creators that aren't really experienced is the pacing. And to kind of go back to something Manny and I mentioned before, especially with these Aftershock books, you're going to get 5 issues and you don't know if you're going to get any more, then you're limited on your space. And if you're only going to get 5 issues and you want to tell the whole story, then what do you cut? And that can lead to some choppiness in pacing as well. So especially if you're not, you know, a seasoned comic professional. So I know Inaki Miranda, he's worked on other series before as an artist, but I don't think he's ever written anything. And his brother, Roy Miranda, actually comes from the creative field of music. And so he hasn't written anything either. So this is really their first foray into, you know, writing their own comic. And so, while I'm not going to give them a pass for the pacing and the choppiness, it is understandable. And so it's still enjoyable. And I can kind of see where they're drawing some inspiration from. I don't want to mention it because I want people to read it for themselves. But there's also some things that happen in the book that are surprising, where you go, oh, you know, you didn't expect that. And so as a reader, it's nice to sometimes have those little surprises as well. So I wanted to mention issue 2 because I do think the series is worth reading. Plus, from a collectability standpoint, issue 1 did sell out. It's going for a little bit of cash. And tomorrow, if you missed out on issue 1, the second printing of issue 1 is going to be on stands, or today, I guess, as you hear this, tomorrow as we're recording it. So you can pick up issue 1 and 2 together. As far as the art goes, it very much suits the adventure and sort of kids kind of take on the book. It's not too visceral or too bloody. I mean, it's very much cartoon violence. There are a couple scenes with the animals that are kind of the mutations attacking people, and there's a little bit of blood, but it's not gory by any means. And so the art does suit kind of that adventure, the big bombastic kind of story that they're trying to tell. I just wonder if the limitations, you know, of only having 5 or 6 issues to tell it are kind of impeding on their ability to tell a good story. And then, like I said, you know, they don't have a lot of experience under their belt telling stories on their own. So I think this is probably a good learning experience for them. And the story has been fun so far, and I have been enjoying it despite the choppiness. So I recommend giving it a try. The other thing I want to mention is I didn't see this in the first issue. So I'd have to go back and look, but in this issue, there's a QR code that you can scan where it'll play some original music. And I imagine that's probably from Roy Miranda and his ties to the music industry. So there's some original music that you can play and have it playing in the background while you read the issue, that kind of helps to set the tone and the mood. So I thought that was kind of interesting as well. All right, Manny, you have one more book?
I have one more book, and it happens to be my book of the week. And to your surprise, it's Dark Knight's Death Metal 5.
I was surprised when you said you're even going to talk about Death Metal. I didn't even know you were caught up.
Some of the tie-ins I didn't read. I know I didn't read the one with the Robin.
Oh yeah.
And then, gotcha. There was actually, I think somehow you've like spoon fed me them. I've been caught up.
There's been a lot of tie-ins.
Because thinking about it, that might be the only one I haven't read. All those damn short stories, and then I know I've complained about a couple of them.
Did you read the speed metal one with the
oh flowers? No, that's the other one I didn't read, and that's actually an important one.
The thing about all the tie-ins is they reference all the important events that happen in them in the regular series, so you don't really need to. By all means, read them if you want, but they're not super necessary to the story.
I know I read the Trinity Crisis, and I read the one with Lobo last week, which was great. Anyway, Death Metal 5. So in a nutshell, without giving too much away, I get the idea. We talked about this, that if you peel away the billions of Batman, and you kind of peel away this whole metal thing, there's actually a really pretty good story behind there that Zack Snyder and Greg Capullo are telling. And
Scott,
by the way,
Snyder, don't you dare call him Zack.
I'm working on something more. I'm working on criticizing that the black and white trailer and the Steppenwolf that you love so much.
Oh my god, terrible.
So I hate it. Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo have been working on with inks by Jonathan Galapion and colors by FCO Placencia. I think there was another issue. I think it was issue 3 maybe, where you kind of started getting the idea that, like, all right, there's actually a big story here, a big, you know, crisis, like, I mean, just name whatever big event story that you want to, universe level destruction story, resetting, whatever you want to call it here. And I really get that feeling also here with Death Metal 5, with really finally the return of Lex Luthor. And then also, we kind of see a plan come together in how the heroes, villains, the universe is planning to fight back over this, the Joker Who Laughs, or what does he call himself now?
I think he's just called the Darkest Knight.
The Darkest Knight. Yeah, that's what it is. A reason being, this might be a dumb reason, but you kind of start seeing the unification of superheroes and villains. And when things like that happen, you kind of get the feeling that, okay, this is important. We've already seen the participation of creatures like beings, I mean, like Metron. And we've seen that other guy who came in, who was kind of like a Metron type character who was recording things. And you see everything really coming together, and the way that is actually done in this book is super. I felt it was super clean, as far as the because we have the Darkest Knight right now versus Perpetual, which has been going on. And in the meantime, our heroes are trying to figure out how to stop him. And they figure out a very clever way to do this, and with obviously, because you can't save the universe without Lex Luthor, and that's very, very clear to me. And so I liked it. I really felt like it's picking up, and I felt like the next issue, I think we're gonna get to a satisfying ending. And also another thing is there's things from the first issue, and even the second and third issue that are coming back into play here, that I found very clever. in some of the revelations that Batman and Superman make to Wonder Woman. And I think part of that too is I just kind of wish that maybe it was a little bit cleaner instead of like all this whole convoluted death metal thing, and just tell me a good freaking story. You don't like, don't give me, I don't want to see our heroes fight a castle that has been infused with Gotham and Bruce Wayne. Like what, why? Like, it's unnecessary, which is exactly what happened here. The response to that is also super clever, I thought. That was such a cool panel too. When you find out, like, where did that come from? It's like, it was going to, and then the one word, the four letter word that is so classic in Justice League mythology, if you think of villains. So besides that, and then also like the other thing is maybe it's because I haven't read the Robin King book, but like in the couple of issues that he's been here, yeah, he kind of took a couple people out, but he really didn't do anything, and he's still getting he talks a lot, but I haven't really seen him do much, which was I thought was interesting. And then he becomes kind of an afterthought, and so yeah, it's pretty good. I liked it a whole lot better than I thought I would, but it also just kind of like just peeling those outer layers of the onion and just getting to the actual story and where we're headed, I think really helped. So I'm actually surprised to say that I'm looking forward to issue 6.
Yeah, definitely that Robin King special or one shot made him feel a lot more formidable. Because yeah, that is one thing in the regular series he has been a minor player, but if you read the one shot, he does feel a lot more dangerous. So I agree with you there. I also agree with you that yeah, and we've talked about this a bunch. Throwing everything in the kitchen sink, you know, Batman fused with a castle, Batman fused with a Batmobile, Batman fused with the T-Rex from the Batcave. I mean, all that is just ridiculous and unnecessary and frankly kind of dumb in my mind. I'm surprised we haven't seen Batman fuse with a penny yet. I mean, some of them have been cool, you know, like Batman with Atrocitus. That's interesting. Batman with Lobo. It worked in the Lobo special. I don't know that I would like it otherwise. So I get that. The other thing I wonder is, so how much has this story changed? Like, we know this is something that Scott Snyder's been working toward for a long time, like before Metal, before his Justice League run. This is what he was working toward, and so you just wonder with 5G being thrown out, and now this basically like, is this doing what 5G would have done? I mean, I feel like the two most important panels in this entire issue of Death Metal are the two panels that show Wonder Woman's lasso with knots in it.
Yeah.
And then without, because it kind of explains, and I'm not going to get into it here because it's spoilery, but it kind of explains where DC's going in general terms. Obviously, editorially is what I'm talking about, and how we've heard them talking. We heard Dan Didio at Long Beach in January, which in a way seems like we were just there, and in a way seems like a thousand years ago, talking about every story matters, everything matters. And so how is that going to work with 5G? And, you know, we know that, you know, as I said, 5G got thrown out, and that's going to be a lot of what Future State is, but kind of an, you know, alternate reality or Elseworlds kind of story. And then we're going to go back to some kind of new status quo. So how much of this story has changed? I don't think that fundamentally it's changed, but I think things have been tweaked and added in. And whatever 5G was going to set up, or if it was going to set up something, that's now all been shifted into Death Metal. So that would be, it would be really curious to talk to Scott Snyder, you know, 4 or 5 years down the line to find out what kind of changes were made. The other thing I wanted to ask you, Manny, was about the Death Metal look for Mr. Freeze, because I know he's one of your favorite characters. What did you think of that look? Or do you even remember seeing him?
Don't actually. No.
Here, let me share my Let me share my screen.
Yeah, go ahead and do that.
See him right here? Like, it took me a second to even, I'm like, wait, so this is a bunch of villains.
Oh, that's right. It kind of seems basic. I actually was,
He looks like he has Tron gloves on.
A little bit, but it's kind of like, you know what's funny is I was actually more, I don't know I guess he's going for those metal looks, but the one thing that really got me in this page was the Riddler looking really like Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And then, like, what the hell is up with the Joker?
Yeah.
Like, and so I didn't really necessarily pay attention too much to Mr. Freeze. You know, he's like, okay, he kind of looks like that futuristic Batman Beyond type of character of Mr. Freeze. And then, same thing with, I mean, it was like, is that the Clock King?
That's
a random character to have there.
Yeah, exactly. He looks completely different too. So what, Granny Goodness looks the same, Killer Croc, right. Same, Cyborg Superman, same, Parasite, same, but underpowered. Black Manta, from what we can see, looks the same. And then of course Penguin looks a little more hulking than he normally, a little more physically imposing than he normally does. And then especially when you go into the battle right here, he's looking like, I mean, that's not the pain. Usually he's the last one to physically get involved. So
yeah, well, yeah, that's why he has a rock.
Yeah.
You know, I will be honest with you. There's that panel above. I don't recognize a lot of those people right there.
This
with
one?
Behind Batman or behind Batman. I'm like, who the heck are some of those guys?
Yeah. There are a lot of golden age, characters. It's like Airwave and, Johnny Thunder, Red Tornado. The other thing we didn't talk about it at the time, but I made sure that you read that. Like you mentioned, I was kind of spoon feeding you the one shots. I made sure you read that Dark Knight Death Metal Rise of the New God. You already mentioned the Chronicler and Metron, of course, coming back. Mm-hmm. So he's holding the skull. You know, I mentioned that panel. He's holding the skull, and I was like, I wonder whose skull that is. And then you turn the page, and it turns. It's Metron. He brings Metron back to life. That was the last character, and I don't know why. I mean, I guess I didn't think about it. Spent a lot of time thinking, well, who could this be? You know, I'm just reading the story, but you know, for a split second, oh, who's that? And then I turn the page, and obviously the Metron's chair, the Mobius chair, has been an important story point. So I guess I could have thought Metron, but it's still surprised me. I didn't expect that. Metron's been gone for a long time, and I liked it because I think Metron's an interesting character. So I couldn't mention it at the time because you hadn't read it, but were you surprised Metron came back? Were you happy to see him come back?
No, Metron's a great character because it, like I was kind of talking about a little bit earlier. When a character like Metron shows up, you know something's up. You know that there's a lot at stake because of the amount of information that he carries, the weight he carries. Last time we saw Metron, besides Mr. Miracle, because that's kind of more like a family thing, and you know they're all new gods. But before that, we had seen him was in Darkseid War, and that's when Batman sat in the Mobius chair, and then we waited 8 years or whatever it was for the lackluster Three Jokers. The importance of that character and the amount of information that you get out of there is important. And yeah, it's good. Those are the kind of characters you expect to see in these big moments. Like I'm surprised that we haven't, well, we did, I guess we saw the Anti-Monitor for a little bit and Dark, but you know, everyone's so kind of, I feel like everyone's like so OP'd right now that it, you know, it doesn't, but yeah, like Metron, that was, it was good. It was good.
And the other part is having like Metron belongs on the Mobius chair, like having, you know, Batman on there or Wally West or Green Lantern or whoever, like it's okay for a little while. It can kind of, you can make it work for a, you know, a story or two, but in the long run, the Mobius chair is too powerful. You got to have Metron there, you know, somebody who is more disconnected, more aloof. Cause you put, you know, somebody who's out and out hero on there and they're going to be using that, you know, uber powered artifact to make changes. And then you wonder, well, how come they couldn't just end all crime? You know, it's that powerful of a thing. So I don't like the idea of it just out there. So anybody could take it over, a villain or whoever could sit on it. So I like the idea of having Metron who's sort of disconnected being on there. So I'm glad he's back. All right, let me talk about my last book real briefly here. We're already starting to get a little long, and then I'll give a rundown on some of the other titles. I wanted to talk about Spider-Woman number 6, written by Carla Pacheco, art by Pierre Perez, colors by Frank DeArmada, and letters by Travis Lanham. So Jessica Drew has lost her healing ability, and she's having to take this serum to kind of prevent the radiation that gave her her Spider-Woman powers in the first place from killing her. So as a side effect, this serum that's keeping that radiation at bay is making her kind of unstable, but it's also leveling her up in a way. So she's stronger than she's ever been, but that comes with the risk of her kind of flying off the handle and being irrational. So she's out here searching for a cure for herself so she can stop taking the serum. And we see in this issue, she's teamed up with her good friend, Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers, to try to find a way to be healed. But it's not going well. I'll say that. And due to that stability, even her relationship with Carol is not going well. So I wanted to talk about it real briefly because I feel, and I talked about this in the first arc by Carla Pacheco, where she kind of has expanded the supporting cast of Spider-Woman and had a chance to keep that extended cast going forward. But then that kind of all blew up at the end of the first arc, which I thought was an interesting take. I wasn't expecting it. Pacheco kind of pulled the rug out from under us readers, which is always great. Like I mentioned, you know, being able to be surprised. I'm sure some of those supporting casts will come back because they're still tangentially involved and they have some stakes in what's going on with Jessica. And in some ways they're the cause of what's going on with Jessica. But what I love is the fact that Carla Pacheco has leveled up Spider-Woman in terms of power, and we really don't even know the upper limits of her power, to the point where we see at the end of the issue we're teased for the King in Black, which is the Venom sort of Null, who's the king of the symbiotes, story that Donny Cates is building, big crossover. That's really a high level power level kind of story. Like, and it's going to involve, you know, different planets and cosmic stuff because, you know, the planet of the symbiotes and where Venom came from and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not a big fan of having all these symbiotes running around. I've talked about that before, but my point being that Jessica Drew, you know, she's always in the past been more of a street level type of character. You know, you think of her more on the level of, you know, Power Man and Iron Fist or Daredevil, Punisher, you know, definitely kind of grounded and gritty. But now that Carla has leveled Jessica up, she's kind of playing with the big boys, so to speak. And so I find that to be interesting. Like, is she going to stay at that big power level? There's not a lot of female characters you can think of in the Marvel Universe that are up there at that level, you know, like maybe She-Hulk. But when you talk about somebody who's just really powerful, it would be interesting to see Spider-Woman, to see Jessica Drew, you know, at that level. How does she reconcile that with her kid and her family and her, you know, previous relationships? I guess Captain Marvel is another one, Carol Danvers. But I always felt like it doesn't really work for me. I mean, I think Carol Danvers is a great character. I wish they'd never turned her into Captain Marvel. I wish they'd kept her as Miss Marvel or Binary. And that's just a personal thing for me because I'm such a fan of the original Captain Marvel, the Kree. But you know, it's fine, whatever. But it doesn't, it never feels to me like it's Carol's that comfortable with the power level she has. And so it's going to be interesting to see the dynamic with Jessica. She's such a different character personality wise than Carol Danvers. So it'd be interesting to have another character that's kind of up there at that level. And then what does that even do to Jessica and Carol's relationship when they're, you know, a little more on equal footing in terms of power? So very curious to see what happens. I like the voice and the tone that Carla Pacheco has been giving Jessica Drew. And I'm very curious to see how this all plays out. The art by Pierre Perez. I mean, I've been a big fan of him ever since he was on Archer and Armstrong on Rip Valiant. So he's a great artist, very smooth lines, traditional superhero looking comics, great panel layouts, great layouts within the panels. He varies that camera angle up, and the color work also is really good from Frank DiArmata in this book. There's a few flashback scenes where it gets a little almost sepia toned, and so he denotes that with the different type of coloring, making it a little more textured, and I think he does a great job with that as well. So I think Spider-Woman is one of those books that I don't hear a lot of people talking about, but I think more people should be reading it because it's a really, really quality title. So, all right, well, that does it for the books that we're going to talk about in detail. Let me give a rundown on some of the other titles that you might want to be on the lookout for. I did have the page open, but apparently I closed it. So let me open it back up. All right, so we mentioned both of the titles from Aftershock already. From AWA Studios, we have Bad Mother number 4 of 5 and Grendel, Kentucky number 3 of 4. Over at Boom Studios, Buffy the Vampire Slayer Willow number 5 is out today. Once in Future number 13 from Kieran Gillen, as well as Something is Killing the Children number 12 from James Tynan. It's always a real popular title. You Look Like Death, Tales from the Umbrella Academy, number 3 of 6, is out from Dark Horse. Over at DC Comics, we've got Batman Three Jokers hardcover, which collects the entire series for $29.99. There is also Joker Harley Criminal Sanity, number 6 of 8, from Cammy Garcia, which is a really, really great title. I read issue 6. It's absolutely spectacular. I love the version of Harley and the version of Joker that are in that story. Here's a Joker that's actually formidable because he's smart. He's not, you know, he's still kind of, you know, out there, but he's not the, you know, psychotic, deranged, way off the deep end, so crazy you can't believe he could ever come up with any kind of actual smart ideas. This one is scary, you know, very much a like genius serial killer kind of guy. So plus it has great art by Jason Badower and Miko Suyan, like really, really great art. Justice League number 57 from Joshua Williamson and Zerminenko, I never say his name right, wraps up the death metal tie-in story of the death metal version of the Justice League. It's kind of okay. It leads into the Dark Knight's Death Metal issue 5 that we just talked about. So it was okay. It wasn't great. And then we got the final issue of Teen Titans with number 47. Over at IDW, Sea of Sorrows, number 1, new series starting there. From Image, Commanders in Crisis, number 2, from Steve Orlando. I didn't enjoy it quite as much as the first issue. A little bit of relevancy, a little bit of politics. I think we talked in the last issue about how I'm sort of not tired of it, but at the same time, I do want some escapism. So it's great that it's relevant, but it felt a little bit like a setup for more of what's to come in that series. So I'm still really excited for Commanders in Crisis, but I just felt like the first issue was a lot more fun, and this one was a little more set up. There's also a Darkness number 1, 25th anniversary edition, celebrating that iconic series and character from Top Cow that's on stands today. We've got Die number 15 from Kieran Gillen, which is an incredible series that Manny and I are both criminally behind on. Has to do with role-playing games. And you're such a fan of Dungeons & Dragons, man. I can't believe you're behind on that. So that's out there. 7 to Eternity number 14. Is out, as well as Stillwater number 3 from Zdarsky, and then Walking Dead Deluxe number 3, which is the colorized version of The Walking Dead that's coming out twice a month if you're curious about that. Didn't get to check out Walking Dead the first time around. And also Black Magic number 16 from Greg Rucka and Nicholas Scott, which finishes up the current arc. Over at Marvel, we've got Amazing Spider-Man number 53, which is one of the quickest reads I've had in a comic in a long time. Something very important happens with the whole Kindred storyline that's going on, but I don't know. It was a weird issue because I remember the solicitations talking about what a like epic, brutal Spider-Man fight it is in this issue, and there was no fight at all. Like, I was like, wait, what? I have a feeling when they wrote the solicitation, they had no idea what was going to be in the actual issue. But there's hardly any dialogue. So the whole issue just seems to come down to one. It just exists for one thing to happen. And I can't say what that one thing is because I don't want to spoil. But if you read, and I say read in quotations, if you flip through it, because there's not much to read, you'll know what I'm talking about. It happens in the last couple of pages. And it's just like, really? I paid what, $3.99 for this? Yeah, I was really disappointed in that issue. So, Captain America 25, Ta-Nehisi Coates is out today as well. Immortal Hulk number 40, which kind of along the lines of Amazing Spider-Man, not a lot happens. I'm really ready for that book to get some momentum. It feels like it's slowing down. And there's a bunch of, I should mention Spider-Man, Symbiote Spider-Man King in Black, number 1 of 5 is out, as well as Venom, number 30. And then there's a bunch of X of Swords or 10 of Swords. We've got X-Men number 14. We've got New Mutants number 13. And I thought there was one, Excalibur? Oh, Cable, that's what it was. Cable number 6 is out today as well. Fantastic Four number 26 was pretty good. It's still feeling like a big adventure, and that one kind of calls back to the first issue of Fantastic Four, this current version of Fantastic Four written by Dan Slott. So if you've been reading all along, you're going to get a payoff for that. And Juggernaut number 3 of 5 is out as well. That series has been okay. I've been kind of disappointed in the art, but it's out on stands as well. Over at Titan, we've got Doctor Who Comics number 1. For all you Doctor Who fans, there's a new Doctor Who series from Titan. And that's it. Those are some of the other titles you might want to be on the lookout for. So I think that's going to do it for this issue. Have you been reading anything, Manny, besides the new stuff that's been coming out?
No, I have. I've had so many movies and TV shows on my plate these last couple of weeks.
Gotcha.
Right post-election, actually that Friday kind of, because, you know, it kind of dragged on.
Yeah.
Companies weren't really, studios weren't releasing anything. And then on Friday, Saturday, they were like, dump. So, no, but I will say that I want to give a big shout out to Joelle Jones, who's going to be doing the Future State Wonder Woman series, as her character has actually been picked up by the CW for development.
Yes.
Wonder Girl series, which for me, as you know, being Latino and all, I'm always complaining about representation, and hopefully this goes all the way through, and, you know, we get this Brazilian Wonder Girl. So,
yeah, and so the first appearance of that character, Yara Flor is her name, was in Wonder Woman Annual number 4, which came out earlier this year from Steve Orlando. Now, if only people had known that this you know, new Future State Wonder Woman had appeared in that series first, you know, a few weeks ago before this announcement, they could have gone and picked up that annual for cover price or less. It's a $4 comic, because now it's going for like $20-25. It may be that somebody on this podcast picked up 6 or 7 copies as soon as, I mean, I bought 2 copies when it came out because I knew there was this new character, and I thought maybe that was the Wonder Woman for 5G because we hadn't gotten confirmation, right, on who it was. And then as soon as I heard this Yara Flor was going to be the Future State Wonder Woman, I went and bought like 5 more copies. And then the news dropped. I think it was yesterday, actually, Monday. And I went and I looked on eBay, and yeah, all the copies were like 20, 25 bucks. Cause I was like, well, maybe let me pick up a few more if I can find them for cover price. Nope. They were all, and I mean, I think I heard the news like right when it dropped, but it was already, you know, too late. so yeah, I'm hoping to flip some of those. Hopefully she'll be the next Harley Quinn. And cause well, that annual, and first of all, it's an annual. So annuals always sell lower numbers than the regular series. And Steve Orlando's Wonder Woman wasn't a giant seller anyway. So I don't even know how many copies are out there, but it can't be a lot. So if she takes off, hopefully I can make a little money.
It's interesting because they're taking these younger characters, and I wonder what they're doing forward, because last week they also announced they're doing a Painkiller spin-off series on the CW, which
yep.
Probably one of the best characters in the CW Arrowverse, I think, in my opinion. And also provided me with a great laugh at San Diego Comic-Con when he asked you what your favorite part of Black Lightning was.
Yeah, and I faked it because I hadn't seen a single issue. I don't think Painkiller has appeared in a comic, though.
I thought he had, but I wasn't sure where either.
I mean, it's possible, but I'm not familiar enough with the character to say. One thing, going back to Yara Flor, one thing I did, so she's Brazilian. There's a ton of great Brazilian comic book creators out there.
Oh yeah.
And it's kind of interesting. Like I love Joelle Jones, don't get me wrong, but I kind of feel like and I saw some people talking about this on Twitter and such, it's kind of a missed opportunity not to have a Brazilian artist on the book. Like, I don't know.
I agree.
What's that?
I agree, but the fact is, I've had several conversations with Jones and Joelle, and I wasn't going to bring that up because she's a fantastic artist.
No, she is. I agree.
At the same time, I'm like, you know, it would be nice to have, I was like, you know, I'm just going to go ahead and be quiet.
I hope they at least get some Brazilian artists to do covers. And either, with Joelle.
Or whatever they do, because obviously, if they're going to put her on TV, they're going to continue with the character.
So right.
Creative team that goes on with the book, with her character, you know, come on.
Yeah, and it may be like with Catwoman, when Joelle launched this current Catwoman series, you know, she'd write all the issues, but she didn't draw. Like, she would draw an arc and then she'd take a break. Like, I think it's hard for artists nowadays, we've seen time and time again, for them to draw every issue. So if Joelle is going to trade off with an artist, I hope that other artist is Brazilian. I just think that's an opportunity. Have this Brazilian character. DC's been talking a lot lately about, you know, wanting to get more international fans and international dollars. And I know there's a lot of really big comic book fans in Brazil. So yeah, I just think, you know, if AT&T is trying to make DC Comics profitable, there you go, man. Put a popular Brazilian artist on that title, to share the art duties with, you know, to trade off arcs with Joelle, or do covers or something, even if it's the variants, something like that can definitely work.
Doesn't Brazil have one of the biggest shows in the world as far
yeah,
as
pop? Yeah, they have, I don't know in the world, but yeah, they have some pretty big conventions down there. I mean, not right now, nobody's having conventions, but.
Well, yeah, I know, but I mean, at the time, it would seem like every year, either Sony or somebody would have a big announcement over in Brazil.
It's, yeah, they have I mean, it's a big country. Right. Like Brazil as a country, it's bigger than the lower 48 states of the United States. Brazil's bigger than the U.S. in terms of land. I don't know about population, but yeah, just in terms of size, I know it's bigger. Well, I've been reading, I think I mentioned it before, Ex Machina, Brian K. Vaughan. It's 50 issues. I'm on issue 48. It's so good. It's almost making me want to read Saga. People talk about how great Saga is. And I get so sick of hearing how great Saga is that it makes me not want to read it. But then I read Brian K. Vaughan's other stuff and I'm like, man, it really is so good. So I'm not there yet. I've never read like Why the Last Man from Brian K. Vaughan. So I would probably tackle that before, but Ex Machina is great. So I'm getting close to the end of that. I read the entire Rising Stars series recently from J. Michael Straczynski, which was a felt like a hole in my reading. That was absolutely spectacular. I reread the entire run of Kelly Sue DeConnick's Aquaman in preparation for the last issue. And the other thing I read was Colder from Paul Tobin. And it's some of Juan Ferreira's earlier work. And I'm a huge fan of Juan Ferreira. Mm-hmm. That's a horror comic. And so and I think everybody knows the cover. Everybody who's a comic fan knows the cover to Colder number one because it's so visceral and absolutely amazing. And it just makes you want to read it. And so that's one of the reasons that I was like, I really need to check this out. Do you know what it looks like, Manny?
No.
All right.
Maybe I've seen it.
As soon as you see it, I'm going to share my screen again and you're going to see it and you're going to go, oh yeah, I've seen that before. Cause it's brutal. Have you seen that before?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So that was pretty good. I read that as well. So I've been reading a ton of comics lately. But the thing is, I haven't been reading a lot of stuff that would get me caught up on podcasts that we've missed putting out. I've been reading all this other stuff, but still reading comics. So let us know what you're reading. Let us know what we are missing out on, what you want to hear us talk about, because I'm definitely getting ready to go on a big episode blitz and drop a bunch of episodes for you all over the holidays. So that's going to do it for this episode. Be safe out there, everybody. Wear a mask, wash your hands. Make sure you're keeping your distance from people if you have to leave the house. Pandemic numbers out there are crazy. More people are dying in the U.S. than ever, and more people are getting infected than ever. We've got Thanksgiving coming up in just a couple weeks. I am not even going to my mother's house. I'm staying home. Even though she lives in the same city as me, it's just not worth the risk. I'd rather would have her for years and years to come after we have a vaccine than take the chance this year. So if you decide that you're going to be with friends and family on Thanksgiving, you know, that's your choice, but just do it responsibly. Do it as safely as you can. I mean, the last thing I would ever want to do is get somebody else sick and cause them harm. So just something to keep in mind. So that's going to do it for this episode. Any last thoughts, Manny?
Nope. Just a quick, you talk about masks. I just want to show you this. I'll show it to you afterwards, but Morro Bay has actually all across their cities cover your face, and they have different ways to cover your face. And I don't know if you can see this because it's all blurry, but the one that you can't wear
is the Batman cowl.
Yeah.
That doesn't work.
It's funny.
That doesn't work. Cover your mouth and nose, everybody. So
yeah, but I mean, it's a good time to still, you can support your local shops and pick up your books. You can I mean, supporting your local shops is the utmost important, but also you can also buy digital if you don't want to go into stores. And you can always, you have time to binge read, to catch up. I mean, we should be taking that to heart too. But
yep, you know. definitely instead of going out, going to the bar, going to a movie, stay home and read more comics, man.
Comics, yeah,
it's a good time. So all right, everybody, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The readings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.